Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of what we're calling Wolfson Week, where we take a closer look at almost all of the books that were shortlisted for the prize this year. So, Charlie, who do we have with us today?
Well, we are delighted to welcome this year's winner of the Wolfson Prize. Yes, hashtag winning. Claire Jackson is senior tutor at Trinity Hall, Cambridge. She's presented a number of excellent documentaries, if I may say, on the Stuarts and written on Charles II. Her prize-winning book is called Devilland, and it's the story of England between 1588 and 1688, quite 100 years. First off, Claire, we love this concept. We love smashing boxes, and you know, people are so wedded to the idea that the Tudors finished in 1603 and then the Stuarts came in, as though this was some sort of line. It's nonsense when you think about it, right? Because the people that lived it don't draw that line here, do they?
No, they don't. And I don't think I probably initially intended it to be quite so sort of periodization smashing as it seems to have been received. Probably that's partly because I started life really as a historian of Scotland. And I think there is a real problem in English history where people assume that James I is a new king and inexperienced in 1603. You know, this is somebody who was crowned King of Scotland, aged 13 months in 1567, who then had a sort of quite dramatic series of regencies, but had ruled Scotland on his own terms as an adult king for two decades before he even thought about, you know, he thought about it for a long time, but before he actually became King of England. So I've always had this difficulty with seeing 1603 as entirely new. I think it probably felt entirely new if you were living in London. But what I was interested in was this idea of how continental Europe saw England, and contemporaries themselves draw their own narratives and their own calendars. And certainly in 1688, in the Williamite Revolution and the Dutch invasion that accompanied that, people saw huge eschatological providential significance in the fact that that happened in 1688, 100 years after the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588. So those were my initial sort of boundary. I was always sort of attracted by working within that sort of long 17th century of that 100 years. But the more that I thought about it as well, I couldn't really dodge the ghost of Mary Queen of Scots, who sort of hovers in a I told you so kind of way over quite a lot of the 17th century. So really the book begins just before the Spanish Armada with Elizabeth I ordering the execution of Mary Queen of Scots. That creates kind of shockwaves throughout Europe. The term Devilland isn't coined until it was coined in 1652 by an anonymous Dutch pamphleteer, but the sort of thought had certainly been there before that.
Yeah, I think I loved it when Dan Jones did the Hollow Crown and bridged the gap between the Wars of the Roses and the Tudors as well. And like you say, like potentially you're not even thinking about smashing boundaries with the thing. This, as you're saying, this period picked itself, didn't it, really?
It did for me. Partly it was also, and I've tried to include sort of illustrations in the book as well. I mean, partly it's just how contemporaries drew maps. I mean, those maps, I have a lot of sort of maps showing things like landing sites around the British Isles. And, you know, as I say, also contemporaries have this kind of narrative. And, you know, when William arrives in 1688, it's not only 100 years since 1588, but it's also happens to be the 5th of November. So by that stage, that's assumed as well, sort of huge providential significance as being the anniversary of the Gunpowder Plot. So just sort of thinking about how contemporaries structured their periodization and the anniversaries that they chose to commemorate, I think probably explained the choice of dates.
What was it about the Spanish Armada that made it such a watershed moment to start the book with?
I think I also wanted to sort of draw this out. I think the recognition, even among contemporaries, that the Spanish Armada would be more important in terms of how it was constructed and remembered rather than probably what actually happened. Clearly the Spanish hadn't just had this idea. They'd been thinking about what they called the Enterprise of England for many years. This was a great period of Spanish hegemony, you know, when Philip II's empire really, really was worldwide. And so great impetus was given to the justification for that empire, for that attempt to invade England by sailing up the English Channel and linking up with an army in modern day Belgium, what was then the Spanish Netherlands, by the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. That sort of, I mean, she sort of had by that stage, even a year later, this sort of posthumous status as a martyr. She wasn't just a reigning anointed Queen of Scotland. She had been a reigning Queen Consort of France. And she'd also had sort of close links to the Spanish court as well. And, you know, Catholic Europe is so shocked by this event and by, you know, this heretic woman, Elizabeth I, daring to order the execution of another queen. So although there's a lot of strategic reasons and realpolitik behind Spain's sort of attempt to invade southern England, it has this kind of really compelling sort of justification by the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. One of the sort of leitmotifs that runs through Devilland as well is that this doesn't go away. I mean, as it happens, poor communications between the Navy and the Spanish army explain why they don't link up with the Duke of Parma's forces in the Spanish Netherlands. There are sort of poor weather and storms. It's pretty late in the season, sort of late summer to be attempting it. And then also the English Navy does successfully repulse it. But there is a sort of series of other smaller armadas that sort of sail during the 1590s as well and attack Cornish towns and lead to some fatalities and burning of Protestant churches. So this isn't something that goes away. I mean, all the way through this period, anyone living on the English south coast would always have thought that the threat came from overseas, primarily usually from Spain, but later perhaps from France. And the Spanish themselves, it becomes a kind of recurrent theme. You know, they always insist that if you could only just get a foothold in the Isle of Wight, that would be your way into southern England. And they talk very evocatively as well about Cape Margate. If you could just, you know, get some forces around Margate, link up and sail down the Thames, you know. So and you look at the maps. I mean, there's a lot of maps at the beginning of Devilland to sort of show just how close these landing points are. And, you know, certainly in the political imaginary, Catholic Europe feels very close.
It's hilarious, isn't it? Cape Margate. It makes it sound very glamorous.
Very, very exotic.
So everyone knows the event of the Spanish Armada, everyone of 1588 and that, but I think it's the wider context of it as well, isn't it? So the country's future is very much at flux at this point, isn't it? Elizabeth I's aging, unmarried. How do people feel about this at the time? Are they worried about an uncertain future?
Very much so. And it's remarkable. Really remarkable in a way, the way that Elizabeth's reputation remains so positive, given that you could argue that by failing to sort of make responsible provision for the succession, actually going further than that, making it a capital crime even to discuss it, that actually this is, you know, the most irresponsible thing that a monarch could do in terms of not making, you know, good provision for what follows afterwards. And although we now know that Elizabeth dies in March 1603 and that there's a sort of surprisingly peaceful succession to the Stuarts, I mean, nobody knows that in 1588, 1589, 1590. And when Elizabeth enters her sixth decade at the beginning of that, the 1590s, you know, that's already older than any of her Tudor predecessors. So I think there is an expectation or a fear that, you know, Elizabeth could just die at any point. And there are at least a dozen, sort of 10 to a dozen potential claimants to her throne with different kinds of hereditary or other kind of claim. Any discussion of this is banned. And most people are fairly certain that England will just then sort of descend into some kind of civil war that foreign powers like France and Spain will just be unable to resist getting involved in.
Yeah, it's quite naughty, isn't it, on her part?
It's pretty selfish. I mean, it's phenomenally
negligent,
selfish.
Really. Can you imagine? Yeah. And part of me thinks, because we know he's a massive dick. But Henry VIII would have been mortified, wouldn't he?
He had done anything. No one had worked harder to try and secure the succession. I mean, you know, six wives.
With less morals.
You know, he was driven by the need to secure the succession. So, yeah, I mean, the idea that you could sort of just announce that you've married your country and you know, that's it, is really quite jaw-dropping.
And it's not like she didn't have, let's say, 30 years plus to think about it seriously when it became obvious that this wasn't going to be an heir of her own body.
No, not at all. And the longer that she has to think about it, in a way, the longer that others have to think about it too. So, I mean, in the end, Mary, Queen of Scots, just becomes this, I mean, yeah, England was probably not the right country for her to have fled to, but she just becomes this kind of magnet for all Catholic attempts to eject Elizabeth. But also James, although James steers a really canny course between, you know, sort of not alienating Elizabeth too much through the 1580s and 1590s, but also at the same time always upholding his right to succeed her. You know, he also has a lot of time to prepare, and he does that, you know, in various ways. I mean, we tend to think most instantly of, you know, the secret correspondence he maintains from after Essex's revolt with a few key English courtiers. But the whole way through the 1590s, he's played a clever game, really, of having a lot of ambassadorial and diplomatic relations with the rest of Europe, particularly Catholic Europe, basically offering reassurance that, you know, this is someone who's not known to be a religious persecutor, who has quite a lot of Catholic nobles in his Scottish administration. Rumours begin to start circulating that his Danish Lutheran wife, Anna of Denmark, is sort of covertly converted to Catholicism. And he is, after all, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. So, you know, there's enough in his associations and his record as King of Scotland that could be reassuring to Catholic Europe that it might, that the future might look a little better for English Catholics than had been the case under Elizabeth, who had, after all, been excommunicated by the Pope in 1570.
So when this transition happens and the Stuarts come to the throne through James, is that a smooth transition? Because it always sort of reads as being very, very smooth. Were the people positive about this, or were they concerned?
Just remarkably smooth. I think there'd been a real sort of fear, you know, apprehension really about what might happen when the unthinkable happened, that, you know, Elizabeth died. By this stage, James's negotiations with Cecil and other key players are so secure, very secret, only known to you know, people you can count on two hands, but nevertheless, you know, he is trusted. They spend a lot of time writing about policy and writing about handover. And, you know, he's always been warned, don't do anything rash. Don't try and preempt this. It will be far better for you to await the normal course of events than be seen to eject a sitting ruler. And James takes this advice. I think there's quite a lot of comments just in London about, you know, one day the Queen is living and then dies, and the next day apparently it's going to be the new King James has been read out. But I mean, he's got quite a lot going for him. I mean, he seems, you know, that the way it's choreographed in terms of proclamations is very quick, and there's no sort of uncertainty from the English establishment. You know, he's a king, he's Protestant, he's got a family, which is a novel experience for the English court after half a century. You know, he's got two sons, Princess Henry and Prince Charles at this stage, and also a daughter, Princess Elizabeth. There are more children that follow, but they don't survive infancy. But, you know, there's a lot compared to some sort of Spanish-backed, you know, the Archduchess Isabella, or some sort of very minor branch of some of Henry VIII's many sort of descendants. This appears uncontroversial, and yeah, I think it probably is remarkably smooth.
England was okay about this. It wasn't sort of now we're Scottish because we have a Scottish king.
I think in retrospect that was a little bit how it was later, you know, when things go wrong in the 1640s. And one of the themes of Devilland is that this is a foreign dynasty. And, you know, one of the first sort of shocks that the English get is when James arrives and goes, well, first thing I'm going to do is, you know, sue for peace with Spain. You know, I've got no argument with Spain. And the Treaty of London is held on English territory. And, you know, these long running wars, I mean, you know, in a way, Protestant England had defined itself by the fact that it was at war with Spain. And that has all sorts of knock-on effects. I mean, it's a sort of big blow for English Catholics who'd always looked to Spain to sort of potentially sort of help them with some kind of counter-reformation initiative. It creates opportunities in North America where, you know, sort of the fact that England and Spain have been at war with one another sort of legitimized sort of various things well. It begins to create different sort of conditions there. So I think, you know, quite soon the English realized that actually they haven't just got a free monarch from sort of anywhere who's going to, you know, understand England and have English interests always at the forefront of his mind. He also comes with this very un-English idea that he wants to create a new country and get rid of names like England and Scotland and create this phenomenal Great Britain. And that doesn't particularly go down with sort of ready enthusiasm among English MPs. But initially, the very fact that he is Protestant, that, you know, he also has the strongest hereditary claim. He may have been deliberately excluded in Henry VIII's will, but I mean, you know, he is clearly, you know, clearly has a legitimate hereditary claim. You know, all of that seems good grounds for optimism at the very outset.
Does indeed. I'm supremely ignorant of the 17th century, really. I'm a First World War historian, Claire. So I have in my head 1605 Gunpowder Plot. And then I have a gaping hole until Charlie starts complaining about Charles I. And I'm not even going to say, does anything happen there? What am I missing?
I mean, I think one of the... Is this a long-winded way of answering it? But I think one of the difficulties with the 17th century is sometimes that either it's a bit like there's just too many events, it's too complex, you know, it's so difficult to get your head around.
Trump Parliament as well. I hear that phrase and I am already asleep.
Yeah, so I don't think that's true. I mean, a lot happens. I get that's absolutely true, and it's a very complex century. But I don't believe that because it is a complex, you know, action-packed century, that therefore one says, oh, it's just too difficult to study. I think that's really quite dangerous. But I think the other problem in the way in which we've approached it is in a way that the civil wars very naturally dominate, but therefore people, you know, as it's often been said, you know, each generation fights the civil wars in its own terms. So there was always a tendency to sort of go, well, how far do you need to look back? I mean, was it really just a very short-term collapse of authority, or really were these long-term sort of dysfunction in the English state? You know, Lawrence Stokes, 50 years ago, as the Wolfson History Prize celebrated its 50th anniversary this year, but it's also 50 years since Lawrence Stone published his Causes of the English Revolution. And, you know, that he dated that right back to 1529. You know, for him, this was all to do with the dissolution of the monasteries and these long-term sort of economic substructure changes. And, you know, that has, I think, meant that the actual sort of integrity of events between, say, the Gunpowder Plot and the Battle of Edge Hill sort of sometimes gets telescoped according to people's theories of the Civil War. But if you were living it through that period, I think there's a huge amount of interesting things that happen. The precarity of dynastic history is shown up very clearly in 1612 when Prince Henry dies. And really, he had been the heir and the son, you know, the eldest son that James had really sort of prepared and envisaged as his successor. He'd written a manual of kingship for him. That kind of throws the Stuart dynasty into some sort of disarray. One of the things I've tried to do in Devilland actually is restore the importance of the Palatine branch that then follows the marriage of James's daughter in 1613 to the Elector Palatine, Frederick V. They very briefly become King and Queen of Bohemia before they're ejected, but Elizabeth and Frederick have 13 children, and it is the youngest of those children, Sophia, whose son George Ludwig eventually becomes George I when the Stuart own sort of mainline dies out. But the whole way through this period, a lot of English attention is focused on continental Europe because that's where Princess Elizabeth is. And a lot of people think Princess Elizabeth is the more likely to succeed because Prince Charles was a very sickly infant, you know, suffered from a lot of childhood illnesses, and, you know, were Frederick and Elizabeth and their huge brood, also a staunchly Protestant brood, were they to sort of succeed to James's throne, then that would be a very different kind of multiple monarchy of England, Scotland and Ireland, but one that then stretched through Central Europe, through you know, Heidelberg and potentially Bohemia and things. So I think, you know, there is a lot in the outbreak of the 30 Years' War then happens on the continent. There's also the exodus of the Mayflower and the first settlement in New England as tensions emerge within the English church over, you know, in a sense, it's half-reformed state. You know, Puritans finally begin to lose hope that James's accession marks a new direction that they would like to see the English church take. So it is a very complicated period. And I suppose the real difference is as well is that all these new vistas are opening up, as well as being a really exciting period in terms of, you know, sort of Shakespeare plays and the first newspapers start appearing in London in the 1620s. And it's a phenomenally, and also under the Stuarts too, huge amounts of foreign contact that just wasn't the case in Tudor England. You know, large numbers of foreign ambassadors, foreign painters. You know, things like the amazing ceiling, which looks kind of quite foreign and baroque in the banqueting hall that Charles commissions in honor of his father James VI and I. I mean, he commissions the famous Flemish artist Peter Paul Rubens to paint that when Rubens is there as a diplomat. So. Whereas Elizabeth had really sort of, you know, lived in splendid isolation, hadn't maintained foreign embassies in any Catholic country except France. You know, James is someone who's always surrounded himself with representatives from foreign states, and is also partly interested in a way that Elizabeth didn't need to be in sort of dynastic marriage of his offspring as well. He spends a lot of the 1600s and 1610s trying to negotiate matches for, you know, first of all, Henry, who then dies, but also Elizabeth and Charles.
It's a film that I desperately want to see is the attempt of Charles and the Duke of Buckingham going to woo the Spanish Infanta.
Absolutely. And it's very evocative. I mean, part of, as I say in the acknowledgements, you know, Devilland's inspiration as a book came from the films I made about the Stuarts, where we spent a lot of time both around various sort of places within the British Isles, but also, you know, we did spend a week in Madrid, you know, just thinking quite hard about, you know, the lifelong legacy of that 6 months that Charles spent there in 1623. And, you know, certainly artistically and culturally, I think it did have a very profound effect, as well as being kind of a remarkably audacious and foolish, you know, idea in itself.
Wonderful. I always think, you're looking at the world as we see it now, looking at politics globally, not just here in the States as well and all around the world, you can see parallels and a better way of understanding it by looking at this period of history.
I was very struck once when I was making those programmes, I did an interview with Fergal Keane, and he was talking about how he always calls the 1640s for him the kind of go-to period in Irish history to try and understand the impact of the Ulster Rebellion in 1641 and the long sort of very bloody, very, you know, sort of really, really traumatic history of Ireland during the 1640s and 1650s, pre and post Cromwell. You know, that's his go-to period of Irish history when he then covered things like civil wars in Rwanda or former Yugoslavia around the world. And yeah, I think, I mean, it's not a theme I labour explicitly in Devilland, but, you know, it is about continental Europe's perceptions of England during a really unstable period. And as I say in the acknowledgements, you know, it happened to be commissioned the week after the Brexit referendum. Yeah. And I finished it the week after we left, the UK left the EU after the transition period. And, you know, I don't mention it in the text, but inevitably it was written very much in that sort of shadow of Brexit speculation and debate.
And this period really sees the birth of what would become the British Empire in hindsight. Can you tell us a bit about how such a tumultuous little island like us is out there laying the foundations for this?
Yeah, and it's interesting what we mean by a little island like us, because probably the English did think of themselves as an island. But, you know, a lot of this period is quite unstable because this island is still at least two separate kingdoms. England and Scotland both have quite different approaches to overseas territories. And then there's Ireland as well. And actually, one of the major forces moving towards British Union in 1707 was, you know, the inability of Scotland to create its own empire while it had the same monarch as England, by that stage, William III. But also, you know, it couldn't trade. It had no sort of free trade access to any of England's markets. So, and then once it found itself in a sort of perennial war with all of its continental markets, you know, it really sort of found itself in the worst of all situations. And that was a very big economic motive to create Great Britain in 1707. But going back a sort of, you know, almost 100 years at the beginning of this period, England England is quite late to the idea of sort of overseas settlement. I mean, there is an awareness that this is something that, you know, the Spanish have been doing and the French have been doing. And, you know, the English monarchy is not as well resourced as those big superpowers. So much of it is done through sort of joint stock companies, and much of it is really a sort of trial and error sort of process. And, you know, it is quite a precarious, unstable sort of history through the 17th century. Under Cromwell in the 1650s, I mean, that becomes the Western design, as it's known, and Cromwell's seizure of Jamaica is the first instance of a sort of old European power, if you like, seizing a colony that's already permanently, or thinks it's permanently settled by another power, the Spanish. At the time, it's a consolation prize because Cromwell had actually tried to take Hispaniola, which is kind of Haiti in the Dominican Republic, and had failed and been repulsed. And sort of Jamaica was at that time the sort of consolation prize. But that marked a very new sort of departure in terms of sort of state-sponsored theft or seizure, if you like. And then, you know, different models appeared. Charles II acquired a very large dowry from the Portuguese when he married Catherine of Braganza. And that included the then port of Bombay. And, you know, the East India Company began to sort of develop that. It also included the North African port of Tangier. And that settlement didn't, in the end, flourish in the way that the government and the court and investors had hoped. So it's quite a... You know, it's quite a precarious stop start, if you want to see it in any sort of trajectory. But I think more of a reason to almost look at each sort of settlement on its own terms and work out the sort of various dynastic, confessional, mercantile sort of rationale.
I think as well, we are going to have to talk about the middle of the century, but I think we're not going to try and cover it because it's insane. How did you... How do you even approach condensing down such a large and complex turn of events as the War of the Three Kingdoms for a volume like Devilland, where it's not the centerpiece, is it?
No, it's not. I don't know is the honest answer. I think because I did write it chronologically, so, you know, I did approach the 1640s having written the 1630s in a kind of logical sense. But I think I had quite clear themes in my mind. And I do say very openly at the beginning of the book, you know, this is a partisan polemical argument. You know, this is not, even if you believe there is such a thing as a, you know, wholly objective and comprehensive history of the 17th century to be written, this isn't it. This is making a polemical argument about England's instability, vulnerability and insecurity and how it is perceived and how foreign. I mean, I think at one point I call England sort of Europe's adventure playground. You know, it's both a sort of scene of sort of horror mystification, but it's also a very open sort of government and society. So it's actually quite easy for foreign powers suddenly to, you know, not only kind of get involved, but actually interfere and meddle and even invade if they wish. So I think, you know, seeing things from that perspective probably, at least determined. I wasn't then going to start looking at, you know, sort of the ins and outs of domestic parliamentarian and royalist campaigns. What I was interested in was the extent to which those royalist and parliamentarian forces found foreign allies or hindrance. You know, it was very much seen through those sorts of eyes. You know, when I was sort of following I was about to say the fortunes, but there weren't many, of Charles I, the fate of Charles I, you know, a lot of that was seen through the eyes of the French ambassador series of French ambassadors who were sent to England, you know, who actually go to Newcastle and spend time with Charles, trying to kind of reason him to adopt what they see as a, you know, as a more reasonable position, given how hopeless his situation appears to them. So I think, you know, again, probably by continuing the perspective that informed the earlier chapters, I also knew where I was going as well, because I wanted to look at the 1650s again, not necessarily from the perspective, you know, not placing Cromwell center stage, but looking at both the Stuart court in exile and how they sort of interacted. It was a very peripatetic and kind of impoverished exile, how they interacted with different courts and how different foreign courts found themselves when they had this sort of wandering, discredited dynasty on its hands. But also then how Cromwell's or the English Commonwealth, or subsequently the Protectorate, you know, the sort of ways in which it maintained foreign relations with, you know, Spain and France and the Netherlands and other places. So, yeah, I think that's probably how.
I think So I'm going to ask the next one as well, just because it's entirely based on my obsession with Peter the Great. It's always interested me reading Robert K. Massey's just like magisterial book on Peter the Great, how visceral his father's reaction, Tsar Alexis, was to the execution of Charles I. He thinks we're a nation of utter savages. And coming from the Russians at the time, that's quite rich, but not necessarily untrue. I mean, how could you possibly decapitate your head of state, your God-appointed monarch? Is this a wider opinion of England in the period?
Absolutely. Not only decapitate them, but do it publicly. I mean, I think that's with the hand of the common executioner. I mean, that touches a really raw nerve for crowned heads across Europe. So I think two things. I think first, yes, I mean, the name of the book is Devilland, Teufelland. That just was from somebody equally as outraged, but a bit closer to home in the Dutch Netherlands. Because what that pamphleteer was doing was playing on this medieval pun that the Angli were always cherubic kind of angeli angels, that the English were really angels. And, you know, as this outrage pamphleteer says, you know, they're not, they are diabolical devils, the English. They have, as you say, put this divinely ordained anointed king on trial, publicly decapitated him by the axe of the common executioner. They've got this out of control, unrepentant Republican government in power, and it seems totally, you know, sort of unable to listen to reason. And now, even worse, they're about to declare war on their Protestant, you know, sort of confessional brothers, the Dutch. They're doing it for trade reasons, but, you know, this is totally out of control. I suppose the second point I would make to that, though, and there were exactly the same kind of expostulations coming from Moscow or from Muscovy, and across Europe. I suppose the second point, though, is that at least to the French, this is only to be expected. And I think that's why the book has to start with the execution of Mary Queen of Scots.
We told you about them.
Yeah, exactly. And they keep going, you know, what do you expect? This is what the English did to his grandmother. At least then they had the decency to do it behind closed doors. But, you know, this is what they do. And it begins to make a lot of sense, too, of the urgency of a lot of James the Sixth and First's warnings. You know, a lot of James's arguments with the Catholic Church had been about the Catholic Church's insistence that heretic rulers could be deposed. And, you know, things like the murder of Henri Quatre, Henri the Fourth in France, by a Catholic who was so disgusted at Henri's sort of tolerance of Protestantism. Henri himself had been a Protestant before he converted as well. You know, absolutely brought, and that was in 1610, that really brought home to James that no crowned head of Europe should feel safe while the Catholic Church was preaching, as he could see it, these kind of murderous themes of tyrannicide. You know, James in the end died, you know, relatively peacefully in his bed. But, you know, to continental Europe is exactly as you say, you know, the Stuarts, and England is the sort of country where they do just murder their monarchs.
I thought it was like, it always feels like, you know, the way people think about our football fans, you know, in the 80s, where they're just like, oh yeah, they're all hooligans, they're all lunatics and absolutely insane and can't be trusted. And like, it's this kind of worldwide perception of the rest of the continent just looks at us and shakes its head. It feels like that.
It does. There's a lot of head shaking and, you know, sort of clicking in an foreign exasperation. And I think the other thing that also really befuddles, I don't know, just mystifies, appalls foreign visitors is, you know, when they come to London, particularly where they usually head first or where they spend a lot of time, is the sort of porousness of everything. You know, there doesn't, you know, there's, everybody just seems to want to talk politics all the time. Everything seems very insecure. You know, if you get rowed across the Thames by a common waterman, you know, all they want to do is talk politics to you. You know, if you are coming from somewhere where your royal court is you know, sort of not only very grand physically, but, you know, sort of there are so many layers of courtier that you would never really see the royal presence. This very sort of open, porous, unstable kingdom, you know, is and that's in the 18th century, Montesquieu famously called, you know, England a republic disguised as a monarchy. So there is this sort of sense that, you know, the English are really not like the rest of Europe. There is a sort of theme of English exceptionalism running through it, or at least in the eyes of the beholder.
Can't imagine what that's like. So, I mean, in terms of reactions of abject horror, we've also got a partner to the north whose king we've just executed. How did Scotland react to the regicide?
like most of continental Europe, with, you know, sheer horror. I mean, Charles I had been born in Scotland. You know, he was born in Dunfermline in 1600, and the Scots had, you know, the Scots had their own arguments with Charles. I mean, they were the ones who had, in a sense, started the civil wars by opposing a lot of his religious policies and taking up arms and forming the National Covenant. But they had never sanctioned regicide as the sort of outcome to any of this dispute. And, you know, Scots commissioners had spent a lot of time in England. And at one point, you know, Charles had thrown himself onto the Scots, thinking that was really his best chance of survival. And there was a sort of long standoff, all seen through the eyes of the French ambassador in Newcastle, where the Scots are keep saying to Charles, you know, we want to negotiate with you, but you have to sign the National Covenant first, which made various undertakings about the integrity of the Scottish Church. And Charles had always refused. I mean, in this way, Charles I is, you know, sort of admirably consistent and true to his word. You know, his son just signs it and obviously then has no intention of falling. And that actually causes the Scots godly more trouble. What do you do with someone who will swear everything you ask of them and then not do anything about it? But in the end, the Scots just can't negotiate with Charles. He won't sign the covenant. So they basically sell him to the English, and the English, you know, they get a lot of money for him, and the English take him away from Newcastle. But they always did that on the assumption that no harm would come to the king's person. And obviously the people that they were dealing with were not the sort of people that eventually drove through the regicide. But the Scots are outraged. As soon as the news reaches Edinburgh, which is about 6 days later, they crown his eldest son, who's in exile in The Hague. They crown him Charles II, not just of Scotland, but crucially also of England, Wales, Ireland, and they were sort of euphemistically out of France, France at this stage as well. But that lays a real challenge. I mean, it becomes very clear from then on that, you know, the Stuarts are not going to be happy just to be kind of monarchs of Scotland. So although in the Cromwellian state, Charles II is always referred to as the King of Scots, I mean, you know, he doesn't really care whatever the Scots do, but he does care if it becomes a security threat. And certainly Charles is eventually prevailed on to go to Scotland in 1650. He sees his only reason for being there is raising an army, invades England again. I mean, England gets invaded a lot from Scotland through the Civil Wars in 1651 and is defeated by Cromwell at the Battle of Worcester.
You've mentioned just then Scotland invading England several times at this period. So we talked about empire, but closer to home we have issues. We are constantly at the throats of the Dutch in the latter 1600s as well. Is it that people look at us and we look weak and pathetic, and therefore this is the time, if you've got a beef with England, this is the time to exercise said beef?
Well, you know that England doesn't have a standing army, and except during the mid-century civil wars. So, you know, militarily, England relies on musters and on local intelligence and things. So that's it. Its navy is recognized and feared, but it doesn't have an army. It also is confessional. Well, England, if you think about it more, say in the terms of the British Isles, is also confessionally mixed. So, you know, there are always opportunities, say, for the Spanish to, you know, sort of meddle in Ireland as well. There's a long, long history of that. But yeah, I think there is, and also England is often at this stage as well, sort of remarkably prosperous. England does escape the worst devastations of the 30 Years' War in Europe. So, you know, there are riches to be gained as well. And really, that's very clear in William of Orange's decision to intervene in English politics. I mean, we have every kind of euphemism, intervene in English politics. I mean, I think at the moment, airlines are calling cancellations schedule interventions. Well, you know, I think it's very similar. I think, you know, William's intervention in English politics is actually a foreign invasion. And what's really driving him is the opportunity to marshal all of England's political and military and financial resources towards his war against Louis XIV, because that will make a huge difference to the balance of power between, you know, the Dutch and under the French, if he can have all of England's resources. So yeah, I think England isn't naturally strong and well protected, but it also offers potential foreign powers quite a lot of gains.
Alex has just jumped over one of my favorite bits of history. So we're going to have to go back, Alex. Come on. You can't ignore this.
I've just realized the questions don't mention the restoration because I think it was so... time, but we have time. So I just sent you a DM saying have at it, because there's no way Charlie doesn't want to discuss her man with you.
With Claire Jackson as well. You can't do me out of this. This is what's so fascinating about this particular period and about England and Britain as a thing, is that we get rid of our crowned head only to bring back his son. So tell us about the impact that the restoration had.
It is remarkable that the same army that ordered Charles I's execution are the same army that invites his son back 11 years later. And I think, you know, again, the way in which the stories that we tell ourselves, the fact that we often just use the shorthand of the interregnum sort of assumes that it's just some sort of comfortable anomaly or some rather uncomfortable anomaly, but we can be comfortable in terms of knowing that, you know, it was just an unfortunate 11 years before normal service was resumed. Of course, it didn't feel like anything like that to contemporaries. And it probably must have seemed like the least likely of outcomes at many junctures. I think it says quite a lot so hopefully this will go down well, but I think I am more of a fan of Charles II than other historians have sometimes been, in that I think he does play quite a shrewd strategic waiting game through the 1650s. I think it would have been quite easy to yield to foreign Catholic powers who were quite keen to offer him the arms and forces he needed to reclaim his throne. And he knew that, you know, being restored by a foreign Catholic power was not going to work in the long run. I think he's also quite shrewd too in being able to maintain enough royalist momentum at a time when even to be a royalist was really a capital crime in the 1650s, but not jumping every time the sealed knot attempted some kind of insurrection, knowing that probably that wasn't really going to be strong enough and he'd probably just walk straight into arrest and execution. So, you know, you could just say, well, he's just naturally indolent. So, you know, actually it's just more of a case of him not doing anything and waiting to be invited. But I think that's a bit harsh. I think when he is restored, I think the fact that he's lived in very different royal circumstances for 11 years, both in different royal courts, but also sometimes pretty humbly, gives him an insight into his country. I mean, the fact that he spent 43 nights on the run after the Battle of Worcester, kind of hiding from, sort of living among his own subjects and hiding from his own subjects is a sort of Robin Hood-esque moment. But it also brings him contacts and influence and, again, a sort of cosmopolitanism that then makes him probably deservedly not very well trusted by the English political establishment. I mean, he is quite jaw-dropping in his capacity to, you know, negotiate secret subsidies with the French crown while at the same time outwardly, lobbying for funds to fight the French in Parliament. But he's a sort of master strategist, really, and he does seem able to keep many balls in the air. So his main failure, and I think he would probably see it in these terms too, is an ability to produce a legitimate heir. I don't think the fertility problem lies with him. He produces at least sort of 14 children. But I think in a way, again, his refusal to bow to popular pressure and divorce Queen Catherine and legitimise one of his illegitimate children also speaks to his recognition of the limits of kingship as well. I mean, I think he does take very seriously the idea that having been excluded from the throne for 11 years, the throne is not something that, you know, is his to sort of just reallocate to somebody else. So I think he is a really interesting mix of, you know, arch pragmatism sometimes and cynicism and, you know, his willingness to lend out the royal robes and regalia to be used in, you know, West End theatre performances, you know, speaks to a kind of cynicism and sort of superficiality. But I think at the same time, he has certain red lines that he doesn't cross. And God may be moving in mysterious ways in that he seems to be likely to be succeeded by his younger Catholic brother. But I also think, you know, he recognises that this is a bit beyond anything that is in his power to stop.
Something that Henry VIII would have been humble and to accept. This is a heinous question to ask a serious historian and a sensible historian, but we are renowned for being insensible on History Hack. Team Cromwell or Team Stuart?
Oh, definitely Team Stuart.
Yeah, you've just made Charlie's day. Brilliant.
I mean, just even on the clothes.
I mean, they were fitter, let's be honest. But what I find really interesting about Charles and his sort of healing and settling attitude is that he does work with some pretty big parliamentarians like the Earl of Manchester.
Who... And I think that's what I mean about a sort of arch pragmatist and shrewdness. I think he thinks he knows that he's only going to stay on the throne for as long as his subjects want him to be there. I mean, he's seen this pretty vividly in his father's fate. And there is little point deliberately setting out to alienate a faction that's pretty powerful. I mean, probably the ones who feel have more reason to feel disgruntled, sort of those who've suffered huge losses for the royalists through the 1640s, and then, you know, sort of see these former parliamentarians now sort of gaining high office. But I think this is Charles's sort of sense. Well, this is the messiness of politics.
The act of indemnity and oblivion.
Is often, you know, sort of joked as sort of bringing indemnity for his former enemies and oblivion for his former friends. Yeah.
You choose to end the book with 1688. You've drawn your own box, if you like, and you've called this the point of ending it there. You've called it a new Magna Carta. Can you explain this for listeners who aren't familiar with what happens in that year?
Yeah, and it's not actually 1688. That chapter is about 1687 and 1688. So it's about the sort of very different visions for England of James the Seventh of Scotland, who succeeded Charles II as James the Second of England, so James the Seventh and Second, and his Dutch nephew and Dutch son-in-law, same person, William of Orange. And much of it revolves around sort of ideas of religious toleration. So James is a Catholic convert whose first marriage to an Anglican had produced Mary and Anne. It's Mary, there's a staunch Protestant. Mary is married to another staunch Protestant, sort of William of Orange. James then converts to Catholicism, and this is a problem for the English, and there's a sort of great political instability in the late 1670s through what we call the exclusion crisis, where significant members of what then became sort of the Whig opposition try and preclude James from succeeding to the throne on account of his Roman Catholicism. Again, as I say, Charles doesn't go along with this. I mean, absolutely recognises James's right to succeed him in the absence of a legitimate heir. And James initially offers reassurances, both during the exclusion crisis and after he succeeds Charles in 1685, saying, you know, my Catholicism is a private matter, I will always uphold the Church of England. But then he doesn't do that. He very quickly sets about a grand sort of re-Catholicization project. He sort of treats Ireland as a bit of a laboratory, and obviously in Ireland there's a majority Catholic population to work with. But in England, he assumes, I think, that there are just more potential Catholics than seems to be the case, that people are only Protestant because they know that they would be subject to penal laws. So therefore, if you were simply to lift all those penal laws, there would be sort of mass conversions and England would be re-Catholicizing. It's a slightly odd view of the world. But, you know, in trying to promote an agenda of religious toleration, he calls this a new Magna Carta. This is his new vision for England. And it is fiercely resisted. Ironically, it's fiercely resisted in Scotland, where it would have benefited the Presbyterian majority that find themselves subject to you know, the sort of enforcement of religious conformity to an Episcopalian, a bishop governed church that they don't adhere to. But the Scots Presbyterians say, if the price of religious toleration is toleration to Catholics, we are not having it. So there's that kind of James's promise of a new Magna Carta, and which is then sort of intersects with the dynastic prospect of a never-ending Catholic dynasty, because in June 1688, James's Italian Catholic second wife, Mary of Medina, produces a son. So it's no longer going to be the case, if this son survives, that the English just have to endure a Catholic king for several years, and then hopefully he will die quite quickly and he'll be succeeded by his Protestant daughters, Mary and then Anne. The arrival of this new prince in June 1688 suddenly changes the scales completely, and that's what leads to the famous invitation to William to intervene in domestic politics and bring a large navy with him, and potentially some large pitched battle to take place between him and his Catholic father-in-law and uncle.
And no one wanted a regency.
And nobody wanted particularly a regency. No, and I mean, in the end, James actually does live until 1701. So it would have been quite a long quite a long Catholic reign anyway, by which, and also James has huge spiritual but also military and financial and political backing from the French court. So even if it might have seemed unlikely that a Catholic regime at court could gain support, I think, you know, as especially with the French revocation of the Edict of Nantes and sort of great waves of French Protestant refugees fleeing into London, telling these awful tales about forced conversions and brutality and violence. What English Protestants are terrified of is that if James's Catholicizing agenda gains ground, that it would then be backed by Catholic force. And it's not really toleration, it's a means to securing the re-Catholicization of England in the long term.
Talk about bookending a book. You start with the threat of a Catholic invasion from a foreign power, to then being so scared of Catholicism from within that we invite a foreign power, a Protestant foreign power, to invade. And it's famously referred as being sort of glorious and bloodless. Was it anything?
Certainly wasn't bloodless in Ireland, and it was certainly also not really very bloodless in Scotland. It certainly wouldn't have been bloodless had things worked out the way that people were sort of expecting, in that, you know, there was an anticipation that James, who was, you know, had numerically larger forces. I mean, James had maintained a standing army. And there was sort of anticipation that he and William would fight one another on Salisbury Plain. James then had one of his sort of psychosomatic nosebleeds and kind of retreated to London. And basically, in the end, that war is exported to the Battle of the Boyne. So where, you know, Ireland famously doesn't have any English monarch set foot there for many hundreds of years, and then finds two kings, sort of James with lots of Jacobites, being the Latin for James supporters, but also William with all of his sort of international coalition of troops. And you know, the Battle of the Boyne is today etched into sort of Irish national consciousness. So it's certainly not a bloodless outcome. What motivates, though, a lot of English willingness, even though there are Dutch troops on the streets of London in the Christmas of 1688 and English soldiers aren't allowed to approach London, you know, it is being, you know, controlled by foreign troops, which I think we've kind of airbrushed out about the way we tell our glorious revolution. I think what makes most English people very prepared to accept William's rule is both the fact that he's married to James's Protestant daughter Mary, so, you know, it's not an entire hostile takeover or usurpation, but also that, you know, people simply want to avoid the effusion of blood. You know, they remember what happens when, you know, the middle ground doesn't hold firm in this sort of instability. You know, they remember that, you know, that England could descend again into civil war, and, you know, the forces against that are so strong that, you know, that's why some people have called sort of 1688 the sensible revolution or something. But I think it's very much only in the 18th century that it acquires this epithet glorious.
Gosh, well, I think I could talk to you all day, Claire, about being a restoration historian, about the nefarious Dutch, and thoroughly enjoy myself. But we are going to have to wrap up here with just a huge congratulations.
Thank you very much. I could talk all day about this.
we're going to carry on. We're going to wrap up the episode. We'll just keep talking. Thank you so much, Claire Jackson, for joining us. Devilland is available where all good books are sold, and you can buy it via our bookstore, so please go and get yourself a copy. Thank you so much for joining us, Claire.
Thank you very much for having me.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.